Is Rep Lively out there?
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Committee on Human Services. Today is Wednesday, the 17th. Thank you very much for waiting for us to get started here. And we'll start with House Bill 3447.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3447 prohibits an instrument in conveyance of real property restricting the use of property as a certified or registered family or child care home or as an exempt family child care provider. It prohibits governing documents of condominium or planned community from restricting use of owner's unit as exempt family child care provider and from restricting certain units from use as certified or registered family care child care home. It exempts condominiums or planned communities used as housing for older persons. It permits regulation of parking, noise, odors, nuisance, and other and use of common elements impacting insurance if provisions are reasonable and do not have the effect of restricting a unit's use as exempt family child care provider or certified or registered family child care home. It prohibits a planned community from imposing irrigation requirements when a local drought exists or is expected. There is no expenditure impact and no revenue impact on the bill.
Representative Lively, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm State Representative from House District 12, which is essentially the city of Springfield. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about House Bill 3447. There's others that will speak after me that can give you all the details, but just let me give a quick overview from my perspective. So first, we all know we have a problem in the state with having enough child care, and certainly enough child care that's affordable for people to provide. And so anything we can do along the line that's incrementally that helps improve that to me is very important to do. Secondly, access often is a problem, even if it's available. Where it's available, that is a problem. So transportation, getting the children back and forth to the child care, those are big issues. And so, again, from my standpoint, the more we can do that incrementally addresses that. And so from my standpoint, that's what this bill does. So there's a couple of important elements, and one of those I just want to point out is the bill includes exempt family child care providers. Used to be they were, you know, friends and family. So many of the child care providers today still are friends and family. And so depending on where they live is where the available child care is. And so the idea of this bill is to make sure those people, too, are available. And if they're in these associations where there's a homeowners associations, that they have the opportunity, it's an allowable use. So that's what this bill is all is about, is doing that, just providing, and it's just an increment, but it's another increment that hopefully it starts addressing some of those as we address overall the needs for child care, and I would appreciate your consideration of this bill. And I want to compliment Representative Vial for working closely with us on this bill for the amendments and that in order to move it to this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rich Vial, House District 26. And I'm actually improving on my career choices by retiring from law and now becoming a state legislator. But in my prior career, I did focus on homeowner association matters and as such was interested in this bill. Homeowner associations clearly are the predominance of all new housing that is being done in the state at this point. And so to restrict the ability for folks to maintain appropriate care facilities in homeowner associations is something that we're certainly concerned about rectifying. And this bill came primarily out of a situation where a homeowners association denied a couple the opportunity to have a facility in their home in a circumstance that they should not have done so, in my opinion. That being said, homeowner associations are governed by recorded CC&Rs, and those are covenants which run with the land and frequently contain provisions regarding parking and livability issues that folks who buy in expect to be able to enforce those covenants. As amended, this bill would allow those covenants to continue to be enforced in a reasonable fashion so long as they did not prohibit the establishment of the care facility. As Representative Lively mentioned, one of the very important portions of this is to recognize the federally enabled elderly projects, which are allowed so long as they really do provide for the elderly, the 55 and older projects that we've heard about, and establishing a care facility in one of those projects contrary to the project's rules would be prohibited. With the Dash 2 amendments, the folks that I've worked with are fully in support of the bill, and we'd recommend its passage. I know that there is at least one member of the HOA community, a lawyer who is also president of his homeowners association, here to testify, and I believe you'll hear support from him as well.
And just to clarify, the Dash 2 was already adopted into the engrossed bill, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, are there any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Are there any restrictions on the number of people that could live in a facility?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, there may be otherwise in the declaration of the condominium or planned community a restriction on the number of persons who can occupy a unit. Statutorily, that is allowed. That would then probably, I mean, we haven't fleshed this out, but that would then probably be a restriction that the state folks that regulate the creation of these child care facilities would have to take into consideration when setting the maximum number of children that could be seen in any particular home.
And there are restrictions, depending on the type of child care facility there is, there's already restrictions on the number of children they can care for, but the two might at some point.
It has to do with square footage, number of bathrooms, can be assorted things, but that may be in the declaration, and this does provide that those sorts of declaration provisions can continue to be enforced.
A follow-up? Does this bill violate contractual obligations?
As written, no. The A engrossed version, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, it contains those exceptions to the allowance of the child care facility, which allows the homeowners association to enforce its contractual obligations as contained in the declaration.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
There any other questions? All right.
Yes. Great to have.
Okay.
Representative Vile has come to every one of the committees I serve on to talk about HOAs. So thank you.
Thank you. Next we have, John Gibbon and Kate Newhall.
Madam Chair Geisler and members of the committee, my name is John Gibbon. I'm an attorney, the one that Mr. Vile referred to, but I would correct his statement. I'm nominated for president of the Southwest Neighborhoods Association in Southwest Portland. I'll know next week. I'm kind of in that situation I'm sure you've all been in.
Good luck with your election.
Waiting for the returns. But I also live in a homeowners association in Southwest Portland, and because I live in a homeowners association, I've made it my specialty over the last 10 or 15 years in the practice of law to represent homeowners in homeowners associations. So usually what I do is represent, and I have represented people that are trying to get permission to do something with their home, put a business like this in their homes. I'm also on something called the Condominium and Homeowners Association Working Group, which is mostly real estate developers, lawyers, Mr. Vile, who represented homeowners associations. So I'm speaking on their behalf today, which is kind of unusual because they often see me as a little bit of in opposition. But I think everybody on that committee recognizes the situation we have with child care in this state. We've got to do a little bit of giving in this situation. And as a homeowner in a homeowners association, I really want to speak to the Dash 2 amendments and say it's really important that we have we as homeowners have reasonable ability to make reasonable rules about parking and to require some level of insurance. And those are just vital in the operation of a homeowners association. So I recommend them to you, and I recommend this bill to you. And I would also say the situation that the proponent of this bill described was disappointing, to say the least, in terms of not being given an opportunity to do that kind of business in his home.
Thank you so much. And just to clarify again, the Dash 2 amendment's already been incorporated into the Angrost bill.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today testifying on behalf of Family Forward Oregon. We're here today in support of House Bill 3447 and think that it's a pretty common sense approach to homeowners association and child care facilities. We think that, I think as you testified to, the homeowner should be able to do the business that they want in their home, provided that it doesn't intrude on those noise insurance type policies. I think that what we come to this from the perspective of, we all know that we have a shortage of child care providers in this state, and that there's far more demand than there are the providers there to meet them. So even though this is not something that by any means is going to solve our child care crisis and access to providers, I think it is definitely a step in the right direction. And if people want to be providing child care in their own homes, we shouldn't be precluding that. So with that, I will leave it to others who.
All right. Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To play devil's advocate, you have a senior community, 55 and above, and everyone lives in an individual house, but they're pretty close together. When one purchases into there, one would assume a sense of community, one, but also a sense of quietness and propriety. And suddenly, next door, you've got six kids every day. Is that a reasonable conclusion, or would there not be six kids?
My understanding is the two amendments deal with the specific federally adopted rules for senior housing. Like, for instance, I used to practice in Tigard, and Summerfield would be a good example, or good parts of King City. And those are, as I understand it, exempted out. And that, I will be honest with you, I've had clients or people contact me with problems in those communities where grandparents want to take their kids in, and they're not allowed to do that. And I've had to say, look, this is a senior community when they meet the federal standards for that, and we've exempted those out of this bill, as I understand it. So that kind of problem is not going to be that great. But what I'd say is, I'm right in the middle of helping my own homeowners association rewrite the documents, and I'm the youngest of the second youngest of five people on our committee that's working on it, and we were discussing this bill last week. And most of, you've described my homeowners association, although there's no age restriction in my homeowners association, and none of the people who are older than me on that committee thought that this was a bad idea. They understand when you live in a community that doesn't have that absolute age restriction, people understand that these kind of activities are needed in the neighborhoods.
Quick follow-up. If there a problem arises, is there a solution in your bill so that the business can be removed from this situation?
Well, I think Mr. Vile, Representative Vile, pointed out that there's licensing issues here that will have to be worked out in the administrative rules. And in the end, I mean, you have the right to enforce your parking rules. You have the right to require insurance. And if those rules are not followed, then, you know, I don't advise my clients I advise them to go through the process, get the approvals, get their permits in writing, which doesn't happen often enough in homeowners associations, and stick to them. So if you don't, there are enforcement mechanisms. And hopefully working with the licensing agency and the homeowners associations, we can make those things happen so that rules are followed.
But there is no enforcement enforcement regulations in the bill.
Other than the ability to require them to produce, that they have to follow a series of rules about livability, noise, it's enabled, I would say, but there are no specific regulations in the bill that require that at this point, no.
Okay. Chair Gelser, if I may, and Senator Olson, just related to these two points, I just want to draw your attention to two provisions of the bill. In Section 4.3 is the provision that you're referring to about the housing for older persons and the exemption for those types of communities. And then the other section that I want to draw your attention to is Section 4.2 that says that there's nothing that prohibits the homeowners association from adopting or enforcing the condominium's governing provisions that talk about parking, noise, odors, nuisance, use of common elements, so long as that they're reasonable and don't preclude the child care facility in the homeowners association.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you both so much. All right, next up we have Andrea Salinas, Elvis Argueta, and Tracy Lang. And is there anybody else that meant to sign up for House Bill 3447A, which has been engrossed with the Dash 2 amendment? Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the contract lobbyist for Oregon AFSCME Council 75. Thank you for your continued work to help ensure that families in Oregon have access to quality child care in the communities in which they live. AFSCME represents both registered and certified in-home child care providers, also known as Family Child Care, through Local 132, Child Care Providers Together. We appreciate the work of Senator Boquist, Representative Lively, and Representative Vile to address the issue of child care providers in homeowners associations in both HB 3447A and SB 1051. We had a robust discussion last week in the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee, and it appears that both providers and HOAs have a clearer understanding of the intent of reasonable accommodation, which I think is what Senator Olson was getting at under HB 3447, and what restrictions and activities may be allowed for child care providers. AFSCME's goal is to provide families with the needed affordable child care in the communities in which they live. And we know that as housing demands increase and developers try to keep pace with the increased demand for additional housing units, the units that come online are more likely to be in HOA communities. Condo units are typically more affordable for younger people just starting out and with small children. So we want to be able to find the right balance of providing additional child care in these communities while keeping our HOAs safe and in compliance with the HOA's bylaws. Licensed family child care settings are regulated by the state, have regular inspections in the Early Learning Division's Office of Child Care and Department of Human Services, and the providers and any staff that they employ require a basic level of training each year. The training includes basic health and safety, as well as developing curriculum for the programs, and it includes educational and physical activities. They have rules about supervising children inside and outside of the house at every moment those children are in the provider's care, and children aren't left unattended or simply left to their own devices. Providers are subject to ratios and numbers of children in their care, and concerns have been raised with regards to excessive numbers of children in common areas of the HOAs, such as outdoor areas and swimming pools. A certified provider must have the required number of square footage both inside the home to accommodate the provider to children ratios and number of children under their care, but they also must have similar ratios when the children play outside of the home. With regards to swimming pools and water play, there are really specific rules and regulations that our providers must follow. There are rules on proper diapering and restrictions on swimming ability of the children. And there are specific guidelines for the providers and their participation in the swimming activities. And I included all of the swimming rules into my written testimony for reference. So clearly, HB 3447A is not the only solution needed to help ensure families have access to all this affordable quality child care that's needed right now, but it is one way that we can help. We are very happy that this bill does include license-exempt providers and remains hopeful that all parties moving forward will reach reasonable accommodations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elvis Argueta. People call me Elvis. I am in the building. and so I work with SEIU Local 503. I'm here to support HB 3447, which represents regulated subsidy providers, which is also known as license-exempt providers, which is also known as family, friends, and neighbors. So sorry, there's a lot of acronyms there. There's just been a lot of transition in the last year. It is important to know that when we're talking about child care providers that participate in particularly the employment-related daycare program, we're talking about a variety of providers, some of which Andrea just mentioned, registered and certified. Our providers usually have a close relationship to the family and are caring for children at the request of a parent or someone who they know personally. These are not small business owners that I represent. Sometimes it's grandma, aunt, or another friend or neighbor. Our providers can only have a maximum of 3 children, and often they're providing care outside of the usual 9-to-5, thereby ensuring that children have care during non-traditional hours. Our providers are subject to state, federal, and safety rules just as much as theirs, which help provide a roadmap for child care providers to have an environment that is welcoming to everyone. Our providers are required to have at least one monitoring visit to their home annually and continually, and have ongoing checks in their home on a variety of things, something as small as like how clean the toys are. There shouldn't be waiting pools, the various safety checks, a background check for everybody over 16 in the household.
And Elvis, I'm going to ask you to summarize. Elvis, we're really short on time.
Yeah, no worries.
Thank you.
So, as you know, DHS has previously presented to this committee the lack of providers that we've had recently and the increased impact of some of the regulations coming from the federal government. So I just want to make sure that as we create doing these rules, we want to make sure that we don't have unintended consequences or set up barriers that are unneeded to child care, especially as Andrea said, a lot of the new homes, especially in what we call child care deserts, rural areas, are building planned communities. So we want to make sure that folks have access to child care. So I want to make sure that we know that we're here in support of that bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Tracy.
Hi, my name is Tracy Lang, and I'm from Benton County. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I am the constituent who maybe started some of this exercise in the Senate, and then as it's back here from a visit over in the House. So you've all heard a lot of the data about the child care gaps. You've heard the data about the growth and the lack of child care providers. Our quick story happens to be one that the testimony's in place, and so I don't need to give it now. You can read it later. The quick recap is that we are a 4-star provider. We participate in all the state programs. We participate in special needs children, DHS children, and drop-in care for those who need to go to job interviews and things of that nature. So, the amendments and things that have come through has really been a collaboration, which I really appreciate the like-mindedness and the exposure to the problem that this process has garnered. And so I'm here in support of the bill, and I would ask that you would support it too. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for all the time and effort and work. It's not a short drive, and you've spent a lot of time in the building kind of learning this process. So great job first time out with the bill. It's pretty
interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Nope. All right. So thank you all very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3447A and open up a work session on House Bill 3447A. Senator Olson. I just opened up a work session on House Bill 3447A.
That's the one we just did.
Yes, that is correct.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 3447A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3447A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I think Senator Boquist should carry this bill because he started the work
on it. That way we don't have to do it.
Well, it's a great bill. I think any of us would be very happy to have the honor to carry the bill. So I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3447 and opening up. Are we going to jointly open up the two? All right. So I'm going to actually, let me do the two work sessions really quick because those will be really fast. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3175.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3175 modifies the definition for low-income households to include income levels for households renting and households owning residential housing in a local innovation and fast-track housing program. It declares emergency effective on passage. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the bill. And the bill was originally heard on May 1st.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Gelsman, I move House Bill 3175 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3175 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Olson, if you carry the bill, will you be ready when the Senate President calls you?
Absolutely.
All right. So Senator Olson will carry that bill. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3175 and open a work session on House Bill 2944.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appear to have misplaced my SMS.
Uh-oh.
2944, there it is. House Bill 2944A requires the landlord to approve the amount of damages to be eligible for funds from the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program, operative September 1st, 2017. It repeals the requirement for the tenant to repay the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program for the assistance paid to the landlord. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a dash A5 amendment, which was also heard at the same time as the public hearing on May 1st. The dash A5 changes the operative date to August 1st, 2017, and clarifies that provisions apply to claims for financial assistance based on judgments entered on or after the operative date. The A5 has a minimal fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the dash A5 amendment stated 4/28/17.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash A5 amendment stated 4/28/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move HB 2944A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2944A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Moss Anderson, would you carry this one? Thank you. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2944 and open a work session on House Bill 2930.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2930A permits the DHS and law enforcement agencies to collect information regarding military status of a parent or guardian of a child who is subject to a child abuse report. It permits DHS or law enforcement agency to share information concerning military status with appropriate military authorities. There is a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact on the bill, and it was originally heard on May 8th.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster.
Oh, sorry, I didn't give you the right script.
I move to House Bill 2930A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2930A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I just want to put on the record, we held this over and didn't move it because there was a question about whether or not DHS would be compelled to share information with the military, who then might share information with an alleged, what's the word we use now? Perpetrator? An alleged perpetrator. What?
Or respondent.
Anyway, a person that was accused of doing a bad thing while they were still investigating that and making sure that a child who had made an allegation was safe. And we've heard from the DAs and we've heard from DHS and we've heard from the military that no, we are not going to tell people before they've been investigated that their child has made a disclosure. So
against them.
Against them, yes. But nothing that they will not be required to share information that would compromise either a criminal investigation or a DHS abuse investigation, which are two different things. Any other discussion? No? Is there any objection?
I'll carry it.
You'll carry it? Okay.
Oh, heck yes.
All right. So Senator Olson will, first, the motion passes. Now Senator Olson will carry it. I'll close the work session on, and will you make sure to say that they won't disclose information prematurely. Thank you. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2930 and open up a public hearing jointly on House Bill 3090 and House Bill 3091A. And our members who have been so patient.
Do we have the summary? Or?
I think we can let them do the introduction. And thank you all for being patient. Representative Kenny Geyer and I were on the wrong side of the room from the governor, so we could not leave.
I think Senator Frederick is going to start.
Okay.
Thank you. Hello there. Senators, my name is Lou Frederick. I'm state representative. I'm state representative. Look at the way I did it.
You're sitting with the old family.
Contaminated.
The in-laws.
Don't promote my Well done. State Senator from District 22, that's North and Northeast Portland. And I really want to thank you for hearing this particular bill. It is something that's close to my heart, very simply. I have unfortunately had the experience of going to every emergency room in the metro area at one time or another with my wife because she was suffering from significant mental health issues. And in each time, it was sometimes she was admitted and other times she was not. She was in the emergency room and then we would be sent home. And with no idea of what to do, quite frankly. If she had broken her leg or her arm, they would have sent me home with a detailed kind of proposal on what to watch for, swelling, et cetera, that kind of thing. But nothing in many cases from the emergency room when she was just sent home because of a behavioral health issue. And this attempts to try to change that. This attempts to say, let's make sure that we have at least some kind of discharge situation that takes place. It's pretty simple. Because I think we need to be able to do that kind of thing with emergency room visits, and it would certainly help families and the patients know that there was somebody who knew what was going on or at least had some idea of what to do. So that's it. It's not that difficult. Really simple sort of approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Can we go next?
Chair Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greener, House District 33. I appreciate having the opportunity to be here, basically to be the wingman for my colleague on my left, who's really done most of the heavy lifting on this. These are two very important bills. They continue some great work that she and others, including Madam Chair, have been involved in doing over the past few years. They really are life-saving, potentially life-saving measures, making sure both in 3090 that the emergency rooms are prepared to provide follow-up information, connection to other services and things that are really a part of producing emergency services. And 3091 is an important bill to make sure it's understood that the emergency room use for a mental health issue is an emergency use and needs to be covered as an emergency use by the CCOs and incidentally by other health insurers. So I'm here to answer questions if I may, but mostly to thank you folks that have done a fascinating job, fabulous job getting the bills to this point.
Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer from House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland, and I am really honored to be a part of this bipartisan and bicameral effort to address mental health issues. Both these bills passed unanimously out of the House Healthcare Committee as well as off the floor. They come with enormous support that's been generated across the board from consumers, providers, payers, policy people who have been involved in this effort over the last few years. I began working on mental health issues with Jerry Gabay, who's here in the room and you'll hear from, soon after becoming a legislator in 2011, which was not long after his daughter, Susanna, died of suicide at age 21. Since then, I've heard numerous stories, like his, about families who have lost or almost lost a beloved family member, often at a tender young age, to suicide. Sadly, suicide is a major issue in our state. For years, Oregon ranked between 7th and 9th in the United States for suicides and has been increasing since 2000 at a faster rate than the national average. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among Oregonians aged 10 to 24. In response, I worked on three bills starting in 2014, prior to the 2015 session, with Jerry Gabay, Julie Majors, who is also in the room, other families, and mental health consumers, providers, payers, state and county policy staff, and legislative colleagues. We passed two of those bills in 2015. So just to give you the framework, House Bill 2948, named the Susanna Blake Gabay Act, clarified HIPAA parameters in order to encourage providers, to encourage patients in acute mental health crisis to discuss follow-up care with family or chosen family members and peer support. That passed unanimously. House Bill 2023 asked hospitals to develop and implement discharge policies for patients who are admitted for a mental health crisis. That also passed both chambers unanimously. The Hospital Association did a fantastic job in developing those policies. We laid out a framework. They went to the 14 different hospitals that actually admit patients, have psychiatric beds, came up with a set of policies that that we think completely adhere to the spirit of what the bill was. And we're now following up with the Hospital Association to see how well those new policies are being implemented. Over the last 2 years, that large stakeholder group made up of 2 to 3 dozen people in the room or on the phone continued to meet to further advance the goals of these 2015 bills. The result is House Bill 3090 and House Bill 3091. While the House Bill 2023, the hospital discharge bill, only referred to hospitals that admit patients into psychiatric care, today's House Bill 3090 asks the remaining hospitals that do not have capacity to admit patients to develop policies for the release of patients from their emergency departments. The bill asked them to deal with the same issues that were included in House Bill 2023, which include, number one, encouraging the patient to sign an authorization to disclose information necessary for the lay caregiver to participate in the patient's discharge planning and to provide post-discharge support. Number two, discussing the patient's prescribed medications and circumstances under which the patient or lay caregiver should seek immediate attention. Number three, developing a process to ensure coordination of the patient's care and a seamless transition from an acute care setting to outpatient treatment, including trying to make an appointment for the patient within 7 days. We know that it's really important when someone's come in with a behavioral health crisis to try to make an appointment for 7 days, and that, in fact, is the metrics for the CCOs. Many of the CCOs are not making that. I think it was something like 60% were actually able to make an appointment within 7 days, so I really want to reiterate on the record, as I did 2 years ago, and as I have at every point with this, that this is a goal, and we know that often the services are not out there, and it's really hard to make an appointment within 7 days. And we also wanted to make sure that we weren't setting 7 days in stone, because sometimes you might get a provider that can do it in 6 days and another one in 8 days, but the one that's doing it in 8 days might be more appropriate. We did not want the law to dictate the practice of medicine. We wanted to set out the aspirational framework as they have with the CCO's metrics. So with the discharge, with the 7 day appointment, it's says if you cannot make the 7 day appointment, just note it in the charts why, because we think that's data that could be really helpful in the future. Why is it? Is it just not enough services of a certain kind? The bill adds to, in a couple different ways, adds to what we passed in 2023. The Suicide Prevention Alliance, which resulted from Senator Gelser's bill, House Bill 4124, passed in 2014, has developed a lot of guidelines for best practices regarding suicide prevention, and these deserve consideration by the ER departments. So this bill also asks the hospitals to consider policies around suicide prevention, such as suicide risk assessment, a follow-up appointment, which for someone who has attempted suicide really should be done within 48 hours, not 7 days, access to a 24-hour suicide prevention hotline, and lethal means counseling. Again, we're not setting in stone they have to do these things. We want to be clear. We are saying these are issues that we really want you to discuss as you come up with your own policies. We want to make sure that you discuss and address these issues. The second new requirement is for a report back from the hospitals by January 1st, 2018, on how the development and implementation of these policies is going. Since we know the smaller hospitals in the rural areas often lack the capacity to do many of the goals in this legislation, we want to understand the barriers, whether they be workforce shortage, lack of reimbursement by payers, and or the lack of mental health education and training, so that we can attempt to address this in future sessions. That's 3090. 3091, I'll be a little quicker. While the first bill asks hospitals to develop and implement release policies that lead to better continuity of care once a patient is released, House Bill 3091A requires public and private payers to reimburse for services determined to be medically necessary to transition an individual experiencing a behavioral health crisis to a lower level of care or community care. The work group, joined by DCBS, spent a lot of effort trying to identify policies that would bring more parity to mental health parity while not asking payers to go beyond what is expected in the physical health arena. We know the minute we ask for anything beyond what the federal government requires, which is parity, then the state is on the hook. And we worked really closely with DCBS to just say, all right, if the physical health gets this, what does the mental health arena get? So that that definition would really help define what needs to be paid for. So while our statutes call for an assessment and treatment for what is medically necessary in the physical arena, this bill requires a behavioral health assessment and treatment for those with a behavioral health crisis. Having more clarity about what constitutes parity in certain settings and thus clarifying expectations about reimbursement should help build the workforce of much-needed mental health providers. I just want to point out that there's a few places that are like the heart of the bill. Section 2, which is on page 1, talks about what CCOs need to do. It's in bold. It's basically saying that for a member experiencing behavioral health crisis, it has to be behavioral health assessment. It needs to reimbursement needs to cover services that are medically necessary to transition a member to a lower level of care, and at least the minimum level of services that are medically necessary to treat a member's behavioral health condition as determined in a behavioral health assessment of the member or specified in the member's care plan. So that's the CCO part. There's similar language on Section 5, page 8, that deals with private insurers, same kind of thing. So we're just really trying to define what it is. I really want to thank the insurers who have been at the table helping us identify what is reasonable. And there is a set on page 10 in Section 5, I'll also point out, lines 3 through 11, talk about the ability for insurance to still do cost containment, still have their panels, still do what they would normally do, does not ask them to set that aside. And I think that we really tried to address all needs in this. I'm sorry that Tom Holt from Cambia was here but had a 2 o'clock, so he had to leave. And okay. I think that Pacific Source is going to convey his and Cambia's support for this. So it's been very gratifying for people to work so hard, quarterly meetings and then monthly and then weekly as it got closer and closer to the session, to come to something that everyone could galvanize around. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And are there brief questions for this panel? We've got quite a number of people and one more bill today. Oh, great. Thank you.
I forgot one thing. It calls for DCBS to do rulemaking, and we thought, should we add an amendment that, you know, talks about OHA being in collaboration? We didn't want to slow up this process, but of course OHA should be involved in rulemaking around case management, definition of case management and collaboration.
All right.
Thank you
very much. All right, next up we've got Craig Campbell, Ajit Jetmalani, and J.L. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Services. We'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing up this very important issue. We support both House Bill 3090 and 3091. I want to thank Representative Kenny Geyer for her leadership and collaboration on this work. Oregon emergency departments provide frontline health care to approximately a quarter of a million people in mental health crisis every year. Our emergency departments are often the primary source of acute care services for people with mental illness and substance abuse issues. Hospitals are legally obligated to provide stabilizing treatment for all of those who enter our emergency rooms or emergency departments, including those in mental health crisis. But the goal of the emergency department is stabilization, not long-term treatment, and people with acute mental health conditions need a more appropriate, effective setting for treatment recovery. And for patients to receive the best care, there must be adequate capacity for long-term stabilization and treatment. These bills seek a means of making sure that those who come into emergency rooms are appropriately assessed, evaluated, and then connected with the settings and supports they need. The association, in collaboration with its members, as Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned, along with NAMI, created and implemented the Inpatient Psychiatric Discharge Guidelines for patients hospitalized for mental health treatment. These guidelines incorporated related requirements applicable to all lay caregivers, as well as clarifications regarding the disclosure of protected health information. Now, as with any legislative change, there's always concerns that arise, and the association has already shared our thoughts on House Bill 3090 with Representative Kenny Geyer regarding our concerns with the inpatient psychiatric discharge guidelines not translating well to emergency departments readily. However, I wanted to thank the representative for stating on the record those concerns around that seven-day follow-up appointment and how sometimes folks come in at 3 o'clock in the morning and it's difficult to take care of them. That being said, I'd also like to take this opportunity to also echo something that the representative said, and that is to ask the committee to consider mental health parity and look to improving and strengthening the services for individuals with mental health issues outside of the hospital walls, because ultimately that's where they're going to get the long-term treatment and assistance that they need. It's important for the association to raise the difference between release and discharge. Hospital emergency departments release patients, while patients who have been admitted to a hospital are discharged. While the term discharge can be used synonymously for both settings, our official rules, policies, and procedures delineate the two terms. So I bring that up just so that everyone's on the same page when those terms are used in the bill. The association and its members are fully engaged in mirroring the inpatient psychiatric discharge guidelines development process to create the guidelines that fit the specific needs of mental health patients being released from our hospital emergency departments. And again, the association wants to thank you all for your time, and we are looking forward to the work that we have ahead of us. And thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelzer and members of the committee. My name is Ajit Jetmalani. I'm a clinical professor of child psychiatry at Oregon Health Sciences. And I have co-led the effort to introduce acute care support services in emergency rooms in seven counties across Oregon in my role with Oregon Health Authority. I'm not representing either organization in my testimony. I am here, though, to support both bills, strongly support both bills. I've served on Representative Kenny Geyer's mental health task force from the beginning, and I greatly appreciate and admire the effective convening of a broad, effective group of stakeholders. It's really pretty remarkable to get the diverse group together and come to this level of agreement. And I'm also honored to work with Jerry and Julie, who are remarkable human beings. As you know, 3090 and its companion 3091 arose in the context of Oregon's unacceptable rates of suicide. Of course, any suicide is unacceptable. We have tremendously long waits for acute care services. We, quote, board patients in our emergency rooms and our pediatric floors, and I work in that space every day. And these bills seek to approach this issue from two important vantage points and perspectives. They ensure hospitals have shared basic standards of care for mental health evaluation, family and caregiver engagement, safety planning, and forming appropriate discharge planning or release planning. And historically, commercial payers have lagged significantly behind Medicaid, in fact, in delivering acute care services that are intensive in the outpatient setting. And the efforts of a number of commercial payers to participate in the discussion is very impressive and appreciated. This legislation will require that all payers in Oregon cover necessary services in mental health crises, and that should lead to the opportunity to develop appropriate programs across the state. I support both bills. I've written in my written testimony a description of what good care can look like as an example in my testimony, and I'd invite you to read that. And thank you for your support of this incredibly important set of bills.
Thank you so much. JL.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, I'm JL Wilson, representing the Oregon Independent Mental Health Professionals. And I'll just be brief and say that we think this is a very important bill, House Bill 3091. We support it. The bill basically creates a covered pathway from crisis services to those services deemed medically necessary to transition the patient to a lower level of care and maintenance. And we just think it's an enormously important process that's laid out in 3091, and we support the bill.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much. Next, we have Pam Levitt and Doug Barber.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Pam Levitt, and I'm here today representing Pacific Source Health Plans. I will be brief because I know you have a long list of folks testifying. We are here today in support of House Bill 3091A, and we'd like to certainly thank Representative Kenny Geyer and all the sponsors for all their work on this bill. We participated in the legislative work group over the past year. The work group brought together a broad selection of stakeholders and provided learning opportunities throughout. One of the outcomes we were very heartened by was has been the voluntary convening of additional conversations between commercial insurers and community health programs, seeking ways to strengthen partnerships moving forward. The bill before you makes important advances towards ensuring Oregonians experiencing a behavioral health crisis receive the assessment and care they need. We would be happy to participate in the rulemaking process required by the bill, which we understand will focus on developing uniform definition of what constitutes coordinated care and case management. I just wanted to also say that Tom Holt did want me to say that Cambia is in support of House Bill 3091A and very much agrees with the comments we are putting on the record. And finally, I just wanted to say that the comments that Representative Kenny Geyer put on the record related to OHA being involved in the rulemaking, we'd also support. Thank you for this opportunity to lend our support for passage of House Bill 3091A.
Thank you so much.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Cheryl Ramirez was unable to be here today and asked me to just pinch hit and say a few words on their behalf. When someone is experiencing a behavioral health crisis, they need a professional assessment to diagnose the problem and a treatment plan that includes care coordination and case management, regardless of their insurance status. A community health program, mental health program, is usually the entity that provides these services. So coordinating care, connecting individuals and families with case management services should result in better outcomes and fewer suicide attempts by those in behavioral health crises. We think these both of these bills are a step in that direction, and we encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Any questions for these folks? Thank you very much. And last up, we have Chris Beneff, Jerry Gibbe, and Julie Majors. And I'm going to encourage you that the bills are doing really well, and we're going to move them as soon as you're done
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I will be very, very quick, but I do want to brag. Certainly appreciative of Representative Kenny Geyer and her leadership, appreciative of all the people who participated in the stakeholder group. But this doesn't happen without the dedicated advocacy of Julie Majors and Jerry Bay, two NAMI members. And it doesn't happen without NAMI and groups like that who this is born out of experience that often is very painful, and you endure a lot of suffering. It's pretty simple. We go to emergency rooms. There are not a common set of expectations of what's supposed to happen to us there. That's House Bill 3090, that we finally come to some set of common expectations that when I appear with a behavioral health crisis, whether it is mental health or whether it's substance use, we haven't talked about that in this hearing, it's a behavioral health crisis, that there's something predictable that we all, as users of the system, as payers of the systems, as people delivering health care, have a common understanding of what we're going to do, how we're going to assess, and what are those next steps. 3091 makes sure that stuff gets paid for, because there is some ambiguity as to whether or not when I walk into an emergency room or I walk into primary care, that when I'm presenting with such symptoms of what's supposed to happen and whether that's going to be paid for. Again, the analogy being, if I walk in with chest pains into an emergency room, nobody questions the battery test you give me. The totality of the assessment isn't, is your chest still hurting? No, you can go home. It's addressing that as a matter of parity so that we have an analogous response with mental health. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm trying to edit mine down. Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Julie Majors. I work as a family support specialist, health systems navigator, educator for families who have children living with mental and emotional health challenges, including those at heightened risk for suicide. I serve on the Children's System Advisory Council, the steering committee that developed the Youth Suicide Prevention Plan, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Alliance for Youth Suicide Prevention. I also established the workflow for family support services for the ED pilot in Multnomah County. I'm here to testify in support of House Bills 3090 and 3091 and to share insights briefly that I've gained while navigating health services for my own daughter, as well as my experiences supporting many dozens of families facing similar circumstances. While we had the successes that Representative Kenny Geyer described in 2015, the bills we're discussing today include elements of crisis care that were not successfully addressed in those bills. I've had the distinct honor to fill a leadership role along with Jerry on those mental health work groups, and I'm really just so honored to have such a diverse group of people participating in the discussion and coming at every angle for these bills. Even though mental health conditions can be highly complex to treat and our healthcare system can be highly complex to navigate, families really want to count on some uniformity of care for their family members who present at hospitals in crisis. In addition to the systemic barriers, families also face barriers that contribute to the stigma of mental illness, such as personal bias and varying beliefs about suicide and behavioral health, even among our most educated health workers. Without the guideposts we're asking to be provided in law, we're not seeing uniform practices across our state or from one hospital to the next. What's described in these bills is based on research and aims to establish a shared basic standard of care for those in crisis seeking help from our healthcare system. And in my written testimony, I've bulleted the same things you've heard already. Lastly, I think it's important to include patient and family representatives in rulemaking process. And I know you probably are aware that we're eager to participate in that. I want to thank Alyssa Kenny Geyer for her leadership on these bills and for convening the mental health work group for the past 2.5 years, and to all of those I know among you who are sponsoring similar bills and carrying them forward. We really need to address our youth suicides in the state, and I know we're all working hard to do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Gabay. I'm on the board of NAMI Oregon, and I'm a member of the Alliance to Prevent Youth Suicide. However, I am testifying on my own behalf today. And I just cut out half of my testimony. That should get a smile from Chair Gelser.
Though we'd love to hear it, I mostly want to pass the bills. We do.
Well, that's clear. I will point out that I submitted written testimony regarding 3090 that basically from an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in April on the effectiveness of very simple interventions in the emergency department in terms of preventing life in a fairly definitive study they published. And then on 3091, I want to, beyond the fact that everybody agrees with it, so I know it's easy, but I want to give you yet another reason why not only here in committee, but on the floor and in your districts, you can support the act. My daughter, Susanna, when she was discharged from the hospital, did have a written discharge plan. It did document an appointment within 5 days for a counselor at the University Health Center in Eugene, and made an appointment with a private psychiatrist whom Susanna did not know, but for 30 days after her discharge. The entire remainder of a 3-page plan were things Susanna came up with that she could do if she felt increased mental illness or suicidal tendencies. There were no follow-up calls in the discharge document, no contact by anyone to help her navigate the plan. She was left alone to navigate it on her own, and her parents, her mother and I, were neither counseled on how to help nor warned by the medical providers of any suicide risk. And I want to reemphasize again that the entire plan depended, essentially the entire plan depended on my child taking actions to save her own life. As she was laboring under a disease of the brain, I maintain that she did not have the mental capacity to take those actions. Currently, in many situations, it's parents who are implicitly the coordinator of their children's mental health care. No one trains these parents. No one even tells them that they must perform that role. It is not their proper role to do so, but few in the medical profession are currently doing that coordination with tragic results. My child was released from Sacred Heart Secure Psychiatric Unit on April 5th, 2010, the day after Easter. She died on May 6th, 31 days later. When Sacred Heart discharged my daughter that day without any follow-up, without any transition other than those two appointments I mentioned, without any support after discharge, without counseling her parents, they effectively gave Susanna a death sentence. My precious child deserved better than that. You have it in your power today to save the lives of other precious children. I deeply believe that this act, HB 3091, requiring coordination of care and case management, will save lives. Please think of those children and my child when you vote. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for all of the work. I know you come to a hearing at the end, it takes a few minutes, and it certainly does not reflect how hard the work is and all of the ups and the downs and the days when it seems like the bill isn't going to make it forward. But it's advocacy like yours, your willingness to continue to share Susanna's story and your child's story to make a difference for more families and other kids, just extraordinary. So thank you so very much.
One comment.
Thank you.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you all for your testimony. And I think this points out, too, everyone's so worried about HIPAA, and this is a flaw in our system. When someone doesn't have the mental capacity to make decisions of their own, they need assistance, and they'll be fine once they get assistance or stabilize or whatever. So I just need to make that comment because it is a flaw, and I wish we could do something to change that also.
I have a comment for you folks also, and don't think that this is a single issue for behavioral mental health systems. Even when you go through major surgery, you're kind of pushed off on your own, and you don't get a lot of assistance. You're kind of out there in space, and you hope people can figure it out. So it's not only in the mental health area, it's in the regular health area also, that the same defects and flaws are relevant and prevalent to
medical care. But thank you for your testimony. It's very impactful.
Thank you so much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3090 and House Bill 3091 and open up a work session on House Bill 3090. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move House Bill 3090A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3090A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I just want to also really thank Chair Kenny Geyer, who has worked and worked and worked on this and absolutely refused to give up. And it would not be here without your tenacity and heart and ability to just keep working. So thank you so very much. Any other discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, it goes to the floor, and I would like to carry this one. I'll close the work session on House Bill 39, open a work session on House Bill 3091A.
Chair Gilster, I...
What the heck? Just skip that part. Here, I'll fold it.
Chair Gilster, I move House Bill 3091A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3091A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Montes-Anderson, will you carry this one?
Yes, would love to.
All right, I will close the work session on House Bill 3091A. Congratulations to everybody that has worked so hard on these. I'm just so grateful to all of you. These are really important bills. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2008A and invite Representative Fahey and Representative Marsh, who's just on time. That was remarkable.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2008A increases termination fees required for landlord of manufactured dwelling park to pay tenant when terminating rental agreements for single-wide, double-wide, and triple-wide or larger manufactured dwellings. It requires the Office of Manufactured Dwelling Park and Community Relations to recalculate the termination fee amounts annually. It requires the owner of manufactured dwelling park to notify MCRC upon the conveyance of manufactured dwelling park and provide specified information. It specifies requirements for transferring title of a manufactured dwelling from a member of a manufactured dwelling park cooperative. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a minimal expenditure impact and a minimal revenue impact on the bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Julie Fahey, and I am the state representative from House District 14, which is West Eugene and Junction City. I'm here today with Representative Pam Marsh to talk about House Bill 2008, which relates to manufactured homes and the challenges that are unique to this particular kind of housing. Manufactured homes, mobile homes, are a very important source of affordable housing in this state. In 2015 in Oregon, the average cost to purchase a new single-wide mobile home was about $50,000, and the average cost for a double-wide was $83,000. These reflect a price per square foot that's about half of a conventional home. There are about 140,000 manufactured homes in Oregon. 62,000 of them are sited in one of over 1,000 parks in the state. Lane, Jackson, and Clackamas counties have the most parks in the state, and the five Senate districts represented by the members of this committee contain 162 parks and about 11,000 spaces. Senator Olson actually has the second highest number of spaces of all the Senate districts in the state. and of the House district, Representative Marsh has the highest number of spaces in her district. And I have the third highest. So that's sort of why the two of us have teamed up to work on these issues this session. And we have both seen firsthand some of the challenges that the residents of these parks face. So typically, residents of the parks own their home but rent the land underneath the place where it's sited. And this is a pretty unique arrangement. So ORS Chapter 90 has a whole specific section dedicated to landlord-tenant law in manufactured home parks. Many park residents are low-income families or seniors on fixed incomes. So any kind of large, unexpected rent increases can be financially devastating to park residents, especially since, despite their name, mobile homes aren't actually that mobile. It can cost upwards of $20,000 to move a unit, and sometimes the age or condition of the home makes that impossible. Because tenants cannot relocate as easily as apartment renters, in practice, manufactured housing isn't really a true free market. We have in Oregon the Manufactured Communities Resource Center under the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency, which provides services and information to residents and landlords of manufactured housing parks. MCRC registers parks every year and maintains a directory of all the home manufactured home parks in the state. They also currently have a landlord-tenant resolution service to mediate any conflicts between landlords and tenants. Park closures are somewhat rare, but when a park closes, current law requires that park owners must pay tenants some of their relocation expenses. However, the required amounts in statute haven't been updated since they were instituted to reflect inflation. House Bill 2008 has been modified pretty significantly since it was introduced, and we're able to reach a compromise point with members from each side of the landlord-tenant coalition, who I think you'll hear from today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm going to turn it over to Representative Marsh to walk through the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Gelser, Senator Olson, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here today. As Rep. Fahey indicated, my district, which is, I'm Pam Marsh, I'm representative for House District 5. And my district incorporates the cities of Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, a little corner of Medford, and heads out to Jacksonville and the Applegate. That's a district that you wouldn't necessarily associate with a whole lot of manufactured homes. And yet, as it turns out, I have more than 3,200 manufactured home sites within my district, a significantly greater number than the next largest house district. So clearly, our manufactured home inventory is an essential part of our both housing inventory as a whole and of that housing that's provided for people at an affordable housing level. So that's how we got interested in trying to do whatever we could to protect this housing stock so that it continues to be a place of refuge for so many of our low-income families. So what I'd like to, my part of this presentation is just to walk you quickly through some of the elements that are contained in 2008A, and you've already heard about some of them. In summary, the bill has been modified substantially through the original form. You may see that online in OLIS. And we would direct you to the Dash 5 amendment. This bill would do three things. First, it would update the required relocation payments to tenants when a park closes.
Representative Marsh, just to clarify, the Dash 5 amendment was already adopted, right? It's not never. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. First, it would update the required relocation payments to tenants when a park closes from $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000 to $6,000, $8,000, and $10,000 for single, double, and triple white homes, respectively. These amounts will be adjusted for inflation moving forward. Of course, our hope, certainly our intent, is that parks don't close. We want people to be able to stay in them. But in the event that a park closes, as Rep. Fahey noted, this is a significant event in the lives of a tenant because of the difficulty of relocating a unit to any other location. The second thing the bill would do is to require park owners upon the sale to notify the Manufactured Communities Resource Center, MCRC, that is the state, of the date of sale, the price, the purchaser, and the number of vacant spaces in the park. We simply want to be able to accumulate some data up at the state level so that we know what's going on with this housing sector. And the third thing the bill would do is to make a very small change to co-op membership requirements, which would allow a manufactured park nonprofit co-op to better take advantage of federal rural development program funds for the purchase of homes. So really a technical fix there. According to the Legislative Fiscal Office, this measure as amended will have minimal fiscal impact. And we would finally note that the bill passed the House 54-6 with bipartisan support, and it is supported by representatives of both sides of the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition. And I think you may hear from them later today.
Great.
So thank you.
Thank you both very much. Are there questions for this panel?
Nope.
Thank you both very much, representatives. And we have, to close out our day with 5 minutes left in our hearing, Chuck Carpenter and John Van Lathingham.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Van Lathingham, Lane County Legal Aid, Oregon Law Center. We represent the two sides of the coalition, and we support this bill, period.
Wow. That is the most excellent testimony ever.
I'm Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 531 parks in the state of Oregon, and that comes out to be about 32,000 spaces. We support this bill fully, and we hope you pass it. It comes down to that. Pretty easy.
I have been in so many meetings with the, like, hearings with the two of you. This is, thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none.
All right.
I really hesitate to ask.
Yeah. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2008 and open a work session on House Bill 2008. Senator Olson.
Oh, here's your scripts.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2008-A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2008-A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Excellent work on this to everybody that was here. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Knope, would you carry this one?
Sure.
So Senator Knope will carry. 2008 heads to the floor. We have completed our agenda for the day. I have to close the work session on 2008, and we're adjourned. Work session 2008, and we're adjourned. So, I have to close.